Should go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a deed? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
Not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
Alright, welcome back to the show. This is Three Lefts, your source for radical talk, analysis, and so on, so on. So we're gonna go. So we're in our second hour now.
I'm intro. Still here.
Yes, I'm joined by Leela Kapow. Say I'm close enough.
Live in the studio.
Yeah. So yeah.
Or not close. Live if you're listening to this via podcast.
Oh yes. Found on all the major media podcast apps: iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Not yet on Spotify. I keep being bugged by my friend Josh. Hi, Josh. Spotify seems to have stringer standards since they'll actually kind of pay you if you get enough listeners because of the ad revenue. And it seemed like from the forum, they didn't even have a set process for independent podcasts submitting content. They have a forum, but it's like, does this go anywhere? I don't know. It's been weeks. So now we talked about education, touched on racism and our thoughts, as well as the general issues via the gubernatorial debate here in New York. But now I'll turn my attention to kind of go deeper with a piece from The Atlantic by Rachel Cohen about a social scientist looking at being able to social mobility is the term. So. I like this because I want to take it from a position of busting the myth that we have a meritocracy in the first place, maybe even the myth that meritocracy is better than what actual democracy and fairness would be, autonomy of people, and not just because the criteria of what has merit is always, not always, but I mean it's usually a zero-sum game. There's one group deciding what merit is. And in our case right now, it's capital. Banks, you know, the ability to make a profit, that is what has merit. That's why our education system is geared towards producing workers who can produce profit. And that is, since creating profit is harder and harder to do these days, to the point where it's nearly impossible to actually create profit on one's own, and make added value. It's basically schools are in a crisis of what to do about it. Now, the answer from the left has always been to have more Montessori schools, develop students as people, well-rounded adults, and not workers. Not workers first. Adults that can work, but what kind of work, right? A well-rounded, critical-thinking adult is not really a good employee. They'll organize within a year. So this is a piece called Education Isn't the Key to a Good Income. A growing body of research debunks the idea that school quality is the main determinant of economic mobility. So these are all those other issues mentioned, like how Averill Park, its students go to Harvard. But is it because they're the best school in the region? Not really. So first, there's one of the founding myths of American ideology is that of ragged dick Ragged Dick, a 19th century poor emigre who worked hard and became a respectable middle class person, thus the original rags to riches story. A body of research has since emerged to challenge this national story, casting the United States not as a meritocracy, but as a country where castes are reinforced by factors like the race of one's childhood neighbors and how unequally income is distributed throughout society as a whole. One such study was published in 2014 by a team of economists led by Stanford's Raj Chetty after analyzing federal income tax records for millions of Americans and studying for the first time the direct relationship between a child's earnings and that of their parents. Surprise, this hasn't been done before. They determined that the chances of a child growing up at the bottom of national income varies by geography, and I think that was given some national play. Just chime in whenever.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you have this, you like planned out this article before we had this discussion about the school district thing. This is very
relevant. You brought up you want to talk education.
Oh, right.
And so I saved this one specifically.
Oh, cool. All right, great. Continue.
So mentioning this study is actually just the background because it is from 4 years ago.
Right.
But a new working paper offered by UC Berkeley economist Jesse Rothstein, parentheses around his name, I guess, builds on that research, in part by zeroing on one of those five factors, schools. The idea that school quality would be an important element for intergenerational mobility. So basically, one's class is determined by geography. And so that's one kind of factoid. But then, what makes one geography richer than another? And one of the things assumed is that education is part of that factor. Richer districts have better schools. And thus, better schools means the ability to have higher income. Leaders regularly stress that the best way to rise up, and by leaders we mean our status quo, two capitalist party leaders, regularly stress that the best way to rise up the income ladder is to go to school, where one can learn skills they need to succeed in a competitive global economy, because nothing makes sense like competing against people in India and China on the other side of the world. In the 21st century, the best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education, Barack Obama declared in 2010 in a State of the Union address. Improving skills and schools is a benchmark of Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan's poverty-fighting agenda. Indeed, this bipartisan education and poverty consensus has guided research and political efforts for decades. Broadly speaking, the idea is that if more kids graduate from high school and achieve higher scores on standardized tests, then more young people are likely to go to college and then in turn land jobs and secure spots in the middle class. Rothstein's new work complicates this narrative. Using data from several national surveys, Rothstein sought to scrutinize Chetty's team's work, looking to further test their hypothesis that the quality of a child's education has significant impact. So again, even with that other study about like geography determines, they're assuming that education really matters. So Rothstein is testing to see if that's really the case.
Okay.
By looking at the data again, or different sets of data. Because it's naive realism to assume that all the data you have is all the data you need, and that you can make a rational conclusion. Rothstein, however, found little evidence to support that premise. Instead, he found that differences in local labor markets, for example, how similar industries can vary across different communities, marriage patterns, and such, as higher concentrations of single-parent households, that's what he refers to, seem to make much more of a difference than school quality. He concludes that factors like higher minimum wages, the presence and strength of labor unions, and the clear career pathways within local industries are likely to play more important roles in facilitating a poor child's ability to rise up the economic ladder. For Rothstein, there's no reason, and this is all assuming that we can not have a working class, that, like, let's say, what if everyone actually went up to middle class? Like, is that I want a liberal economist to explain how that would work, how we could not have lower wage workers or an underclass. Because they do all of this necessary labor that capital doesn't want to pay for.
Right, right.
Or pay a living wage for. His work, like Chetty's, is not causal. Meaning Rothstein is not able to identify exactly what explains the underlying variation. That's where race, class, and gender analysis might come in. Those theories. Nonetheless, his work helps to provide researchers and policymakers with a new set of background facts to investigate, and signals that perhaps they should be reconsidering some of their existing ideas. Joe Vissen, a New York City math teacher, says educators have known for years that out-of-school factors like access to food, health care, are usually bigger determinants for societal success than in-school factors. Thus the need for single-payer health care and free food programs, because food should be free.
The kids in the suburbs, they all have health insurance.
Of course.
You know.
The best. That they do overpay for. So they would even pay less under a single payer
system. Of course. Oh, yeah.
They should know that. We should tell them that.
We are telling them that.
We're not leaving them out of the, it's only 2% that would be paying more. The top 2%.
Right. Boo-hoo to them.
Deborah, the Bloombergs. Deborah Metcrant, the executive director of Teaching for Change, okay, this is one of those neoliberal kind of outlets to me, agrees that Rothstein's research supports what teachers have long known from their own experience on the front lines. After 15 years of this grindstone that they've been on. I think it also affirms the focus, she said, on having children not just see schools as a ticket out of poverty, as a way to rise above your community, but as a way to be agents for change within your communities. So that's going beyond schooling as the industrial mechanism that it was created for. To be bricks in the wall. Is that the whole conversation around education has become so focused on helping individuals escape their bad circumstances rather than helping them become part of the solution? Rothstein is quick to say that his new findings do not mean that Americans should do away with investments in school improvement, or even that education is unrelated to improving opportunity, my stress on that word. Certainly, the more that people can read, write, compute, think, and innovate, the better society and liberal democracy would be. I put stress on that. It depends on what kind of society you really want. So if you just want strong liberal democracy, okay. The conversation is within that assumption of liberal democracy is the goal. It will still be good for us if we can figure out how to educate people more and better. It might help the labor market, our civil society, our culture. But Americans should be more clear, he says, about why they're investing in school improvement. It should be for well-rounded adults, not just good little careerists. Politicians rarely draw the same conclusions that Rothstein does, but his study certainly isn't the first piece of evidence to suggest that increasing skills and educational attainment are often insufficient for disrupting economic trajectories. Getting, say, poor black kids out of the school-to-prison pipeline.
Right.
According to Marshall Steinbaum, the research director at the Roosevelt Institute, economists have long believed that differing levels of skills and education, what the field refers to as human capital, so that's an example of capitalist ideology leaks into academia, which then in turn affects how they view and study things. Seeing people as... and people's life skills as human capital. I don't like it. Because it commodifies, right? Is that understandable?
Yes.
Okay. This time. Is the most salient explanation for why individuals achieve such varied economic outcomes. I think it's become harder and harder to accept explanations like the so-called skills gap, referencing the popular idea that low-income people merely lack the necessary skills and training to thrive in the modern economy. As a stronger explanation, Steinberg points to the rise of inter-firm inequality, a phenomenon in which even workers with very similar education histories, ages, and industries make very different amounts of money depending on which firms they work for. So that's an interesting kind of thing to look at there. Why are some firms richer than others? Is it really because they're more efficient and innovative? Not usually. Do you have a thought?
No, okay. Go ahead. I'm just...
Well, we're about to hit our first break already.
Okay, all right.
There's more, but it's almost done.
Yeah.
Ultimately, most Americans would probably agree that leaders should work to build great schools and that individuals who work hard should be able to improve their economic earnings over time. Devoting the bulk of one's attention to the former in the hopes that it causes the latter, however, might prove to be a real mistake. I think it's a mistake to just put it on individuals. People rise as a class. I mean, it mentions union membership. That's not done individually. That's all about banding together as a group. As one of those things that determine whether or not that the ability for families to pass on intergenerational wealth and so on. So you had additional thoughts to bring?
Yeah, no, I just thought that was a pretty relevant article that you brought up, you know, kind of sort of backs up my whole, I guess, my opinion that, you know, it's less about how good the schools are, quote unquote, and more about, you know, the socioeconomic factors surrounding the populations that attend those school districts, you know. I was trying to explain to somebody the other day, you know, like, you can't just come in here and say, like, oh, well, the kids in Albany are bad, but the kids in North Colony, they're just good kids. Like, you can't, there's so much more that, like,
they're overdosing on heroin. I don't know.
They're overdosing. Well, and they, you know, they go home every day to, you know, a house that's heated. And they have, you know, and not to say that kids in Albany don't have that either, because they
do. They're not going to be harassed by the cops.
But yeah, they're not going to be harassed
by
the cops.
That they're not.
Their parents probably had college education. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, it's one of those things where you have to look at everything surrounding those communities. And again, I bring it up, like, redlining really did kind of, like, divvy up these areas and create these little, like, enclaves of, you know, white affluence versus, you know,
that
more
even
poverty-stricken
if you're a
black
areas. With a state job, you still have to buy a house in certain areas. Some don't. I don't know. I don't have a foundation.
I don't know. That's kind of my whole thing is, you know.
There's progressive Democrats give more lip service to the ideas of having better school food. We in Albany in our area haven't done any of that. Like, the school lunches are still terrible, from what I know. I mean, they were when I was there, and I don't think they've improved at all.
They're terrible everywhere. The school,
except
you know what I mean? Like,
the movement of bringing fresh food that doesn't actually cost more to the school district and actually serve fresh prepared meals.
Yeah, I mean, my kid's school has a, they just got a community garden in the back, which is pretty cool, but I don't know that they're, like, feeding it to the kids at the school. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really small, so I don't know. Yeah. I think it's just, like, the people who are, like, interested. It's like a club. Like, they're interested, they go.
Yeah.
Whoever works in it can take home the produce.
Right, yeah.
I would like to see something more, like, where they have, like, a massive community. And I'm sure there's probably schools in, like, bigger cities that do this where you have, like, a rooftop garden or something where, like, you know, the tomatoes served here are from the rooftop garden or whatever.
Yeah, in Brooklyn.
Yeah, because I think...
These are exceptions.
Was it a while ago that they were saying, like, ketchup counts as the vegetable or something?
That was the FDA.
That was the FDA, yeah. It was... but, yeah, I mean, I think nutrition plays a huge role in...
I had to bring my lunch, and if you don't have parents that can make your lunch or help you make lunch or just buy deli meat, then, yeah, you're stuck with the...
Right, and I'm sure it's probably gotten a little bit better since, like, I know, like, we're not allowed to bring in anything, like, sugary. Like, they're, like, remember, I don't know, when I was a
cookies.
Kid, you could bring cupcakes or cookies on your birthday or something. They don't allow any of that anymore, and I appreciate it because, I mean, it's not good for kids to be sugared up, you know, and then crash halfway through the day.
Sure.
So, you know, I get it.
Usually we would have, like, sugary parties, and there would be at the end of the week and at the end of the day. Not a good segue. Well, of course, all of my anything on this show is going to wrap into each other. So I'm just going to segue into... So here in Albany, as many inner cities that have race problems and what have you, crime problems, basically poverty, capitalist realism, we had a spike in homicides at the beginning of the summer. It is now usually hot because of global warming. We've had we've broken the record for consecutive days over 80 degrees, which isn't sound so hot if you live in the South. But up here, it's very humid too, and that is
all that crazy rain.
Yeah, quite bad. So, but back to Governor Cuomo, champion of the people, has announced $2.2 million in a prolonged, multi-pronged effort to combat violence and enhance youth opportunities in the city. How do you feel? So I want to get your, before I go into
Okay, sure.
How do you feel about the use of the word opportunities in the rhetoric and of press releases and politicians?
What do they mean by opportunities? What's my take on...
Well, that can be the beginning of the end of it. What do they mean by opportunities? And that's never definable. I think it's usually like the ability to... Because to me... The problem with the use of the word is almost a cop-out because it's the chance of something. I think the words access...
Well, it's putting the onus on the kids themselves to, like, take advantage of the opportunity. Is that what you're saying?
And it leads to using phrases like take advantage of.
Right.
Like, take advantage of this sale. Take advantage of this opportunity. It puts it on the individual of
right.
whether or not if you fail to take advantage of the opportunity,
then that's on
it's
you.
It's your fault.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've basically been told this my whole life. But meanwhile, I'm looking at like what's really happening in the world. Like, it wasn't a failure of mine that a recession happened and there were no longer any opportunities. There wasn't even a chance, right? And so, and as far as there needs to be an alternative language that we use. So if politicians, as Green and socialist actual candidates do, will use words like access, options, things that are actually like rhetorically certain. Like if you're certain that you have these choices, that they are fulfillable, they're options. Options like electives, classes that are offered at a college or school. These are options. They're not opportunities. But if they're called opportunities, it's like a chance that you get into the class. A chance that you'll get into the school. But it should be the option. One should have access. Meaning, it will happen. In order for this, there needs to be a sort of abundance, or there needs to be a supply of classes, food, jobs, which obviously are... scarce, right? We have a scarcity economy. And thus there is a scarcity of jobs, a scarcity of opportunities. So the best progressives or liberal Democrats do is say, we need to increase opportunities, the chances, ignoring all of the factors that go into what makes an opportunity an option, like what makes it more likely that one can either be employed or start a business, if that's what you're talking about. And resources are needed. More than 2 million. So I guess I'm starting with a critique. But I'm going to go through all of the things listed in this that make up this 2 million. All
right, I'm going to write some of this stuff down,
yeah.
too.
So first, so I'm going to go for each one, and Leela will react. We'll both react. New $50,000 grant to... an outreach grant to bolster support of Albany's Snug Street Outreach Program. Now, I have my own. I'm gonna keep that off the table. But I have my own opinions about Snug because it used to be called Cure Violence, and it used to be to me more radical. And now it's not. But I think they're still doing the same thing. That's what I'm basically being told. Even though they work with cops or something. So this is the general, actually this is just the general, but 2 million support, number of programs in the city of Albany to combat the recent uptick in violent crime. The first thing he did was bring in more state cops to police us.
Mm.
He addressed the systemic, economic, and social challenges that certain neighborhoods have faced. So it's great rhetoric here. Following engagement with the area's clergy members, community leaders, law enforcement, and elected officials, this multi-pronged initiative employs a holistic approach to combat the city's violence. And I think the word holistic is also used in lieu of, say, structural or systemic, you know, approach. I'm just saying what I would look for in, like, someone I would take seriously. With this additional funding, the state's total investment in Albany anti-poverty and anti-violence initiatives this year now stands at more than $15.5 million. I'm not going to quote him. And I'm not going to quote the lieutenant governor either. Okay, so number one, workforce development and job training. Invest $1 million to bolster youth job training and build employment opportunities in Albany. So not directly employ anyone, but train people to, in theory, be employable. This assumes that there's actually a market of jobs. Through the Department of Labor, the New York is issuing 1 million requests for proposals to, so there's no program yet, the request for proposal to help connect young men and women to job training, apprenticeships, and career opportunities. The funding will be available to local orgs that focus on work readiness training and employment for youth at the highest areas of need. So direct employment, okay. The funding will directly support career, but it's in the request, you know, it's not like this is what it needs to be. The funding will directly support career exploration and access. So use access is worth it. Supportive services and retention resources such as mentorship and peer advocacy. Did any of that make sense?
Somewhat.
Next is expand unemployment strike force and pair with career fairs and community services. The Department of Labor is launching a multi-pronged effort to connect young people and individuals returning to their communities from incarceration with vocational training, job skills, and career opportunities to succeed. You know, this is kind of a slog to read because it's just such corporatized language.
Yeah, I mean... They're not really, it just seems like buzzwords to me.
It's completely word salad.
Yeah.
The effort will leverage three programs that have been successful, the Unemployment Strike Force, Specialized and Mass Career Fairs, which are made up, I have a critique of career fairs. So a bunch of random companies, or particularly the largest companies in the area, who always say they're hiring and perhaps even at reports will say, we have a... We're not finding the people we want to employ. That's why we have to hire people from India to come in. And that's why we need special work visas available. So first, the unemployment strike force. I want to see actual data on this. But the initiative currently serves 14 designated areas in various counties. More than 125,000 individuals have entered or returned to the workforce as a result of these intensive job placement services. No sign on what kind of jobs they are.
Have they, though? Like, where's the... Yeah, I don't...
Exactly. It's kind of like the way that an ad for in college says that everyone who graduates is employed... It's like, well, are they employed as busboys?
Right, or they'll be like, 100% of our, let's say, Native American population graduated and is employed. And there was, like, two Native Americans that went to that college, and both of them happened. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's, you know, like, we're not seeing, like, all of the information surrounding that data.
It's like all of this is, in fact, a form of advertising.
Right. Right.
Of look at all the investment we're putting into Albany. But none of it is directly for stuff. To me, like, the thing that would impress me would be money for actual defined resources for poor people. Right? Because sometimes, because what is poverty but a lack of resources? You don't have a car. You don't have a good bus system to get around. You don't have good health care or the car to get to the appointments for your health care.
Right.
the cycle of poverty or the death spiral of poverty, of poverty trap, is a lack of resources. And it's always these little programs, little sprinklings to encourage.
But if you work hard, Dan, you can get out of it.
That's always like the thing they say, right? Like it's, you know, hard work immediately, like, you know, end result will be success and, you know, getting out of poverty. Well, guess what? I work really hard at my janitor job, but that doesn't mean that I'm getting the skills to suddenly get rich.
No.
You know what I mean? And it's, where's, you know, how do you quantify? Right? Like, yeah, like that's probably harder work than the guy sitting in an air conditioned office, the CEO at the.
You're supposed to have a second job of as a student studying at night.
Yeah,
know?
Right.
The rags to riches story.
Never mind your kids.
Is having three jobs.
Having to get child care and paying for that, which is, you know, nearly impossible for most people. You have to choose.
I don't cheer people who are like, you know, I'm doing these three things so I can advance. I say that's,
but also my parents give me money. You know what I mean? Like, you don't ever hear that, like, this these people that are like, well, I'm self-made. It's like, well, you're
right. There's
you
a lot
come
of
from, like you say, like inherited affluency.
Yeah, I don't. You know? That's why I consider myself more woke in that I accept my privilege. I'm going to mention.
Right. And it's okay to say, like,
so
it's okay. You're right. It's okay to say, like, I grew up middle class. Like, I was able to. But you're not, but you're not somebody that's like risen above. You know what I mean? Like it's incredibly hard to do.
So here's the most direct thing that that's in this list, perhaps. Provide $500,000, okay, for vital community center repairs and upgrades.
Well, that means
New York State will provide $500,000 to City of Albany community centers. Many have closed already, by the way. So it's like kind of too little, too
late.
What
community centers?
Good question. Some are literally just a room with a pool with a ping pong table, and that's the teen community.
Like
center.
Over, is it Hoffman Park? Like that, like, little recreation. I go over there to like.
Does that
vote.
Count?
See,
I
don't know.
We had a YMCA that's closed.
Well, they moved.
There
it.
Was.
It's on North. It's in North Albany now, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about the one that that was over on Washington Ave.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not the YMCA. Well, yeah, but I'm referring to the fact that, like, we have no major community centers that are public.
Yeah, I can't really think of them.
We have a few that are private, but they, you know, you have to pay exorbitant
fees. Yeah, there's a fee.
And even the city, with some of its programs in the summer, now they have to institute fees, and that's austerity. Like, well, we have to, like, you know.
Well, will this $500,000, will that, like, wipe out some of those fees that people are expected to pay, or what?
For a year, maybe. I mean, that's the thing. Like, the amount of money, $2 million for an individual can be a lot. But for a program or for a building repair, I mean, it's like the renovation of a few rooms. Or, if you actually do everything by the book.
We're going to buy some new lamps.
If it's a program, it's the salary of three people. You know, $500,000, or a grant for say $50,000.
Right.
That's maybe the salary of two people if you pay them like $25 each, for a year. A year, and that is not like a sign. You know, that's how are we able to build resiliency, sustainability, with just enough to hire someone that usually, because all these organizations are in crisis mode all the time. So the money will be spent, and it's also like kind of the cycle of poverty is feast and famine. As soon as you get money, you spend it all real quick on essential things,
right.
But, you know, it's gone in a flash.
There was let me interject really quick. I have a thought.
Go ahead.
I was listening to this podcast. It's Preet Bharara's podcast. I don't know if you've ever listened to it. He interviewed this woman
for the national audience. He is like the federal prosecutor.
He was for New York City for
he
the
was.
District of New York or the Southern District of New York.
Right.
And then Trump fired him. Remember, like Trump said he was going to keep him on and then he fired him. And then now he has a podcast.
Because he was actually prosecuting political criminals.
Yes. Yes.
Not all of them.
He's a cool dude. Like, I really like his podcast. Sure. He has like a lot of diverse voices on there. They were kind of like tapping him to run for, was it Attorney General? like yeah. after the whole Schneiderman thing.
That makes sense.
So, and he was kind of, like, he was kind of like played coy about it. Like, oh, I don't know, maybe. Oh. But anyway, he's got this podcast. He had this woman on who's a lawyer, who's like a defense attorney. And she started this program at Rikers Island where she would go in and basically like taught a class about owning your own business, like entrepreneurship. And at the end, all of these guys had to come up with like a concrete like business model. Mm-hmm. And she funded a lot of them, like when they got released out of prison, mm-hmm. she was able to fund
yeah.
them to actually start this business yeah. and then hire other people who were like, she didn't like the term ex-con.
Yeah.
She was like that
former
because
prisoner.
That just like sticks that label on them forever.
She was, like, former
yeah,
prisoner
I don't remember.
Or...
I mean, because I'm just remembering this sure. now. If I had thought of it before we went on air, I would have like looked it up. But she, yeah, I mean, she basically, and there's been so many like success stories. And if only this kind of money could go into programs like that, where it's like we're going to literally give you
the money
yeah. to start, like come up with a business plan. And it could be anything. It doesn't have to
That's still strings attached.
Yeah.
But sure. I mean,
well, one of the guys, they interviewed one of the guys that had like was like a success story of this program. And he started a gym. Mm-hmm. And it yeah. was like a prison gym. Like they would do like prison workouts, I guess.
We have a gym under this studio.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. But yeah, I mean, so basically, and this guy's really successful, and he's been able to hire a lot of his buddies since
sure.
they've come out. And, you know, I feel like instead of
it just has to be an investment.
It just has to be, like, monetary investment in
yeah.
actual people and not these, like, institutions that aren't
Banks
really...
aren't going to do it.
Yeah, like, I've lived in Albany pretty much my... I mean, like, I've lived in the burbs, and I hate when people say they're from Albany, but really they're from, like, not Albany at all.
Latham.
Yeah. Like, I live in the city of Albany. Like, I own property
yeah.
here. Like, I pay taxes to the city.
All right.
We're just talking about, like, opportunities for,
oh, yeah.
and, you know, things that are supposedly going to curb the violence issue
yeah.
in the city of Albany.
I think generally, so, yeah, this is a whole, crime is a consequence of poverty, or rather, inequality, actually. So if everyone in a city, say, is poor... crime is would also be low. It is inequality that causes crime, and this is more like, I suppose, the general
what
society.
Are we even calling crime, because there's like different types of crime,
of course.
Obviously there's like, you
and
know,
this is assuming
like Paul Manafort crime.
How about direct violence?
Direct violence, yeah, 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 okay.
Direct violence, this is homicide, because there's all the crimes that the city of Albany prosecutes and fills the our city court with. So if you want to know how fair the justice system is, just go to a court one day and see who's coming in and out. It ain't people wearing suits. But yeah, there's just that. I mean, this is a debate to have with people across the spectrum about like the demand of abolishing the police. Like, what does that mean? Even A, what does it mean? What's your alternative? But it's just the conceit that the police were created to protect property. It's like a protection racket. If you're not paying property taxes, the police don't really care. Rather, they're you're the ones being policed, and the police exist to protect property owners. So, if you want to think about the police as a gang, and there are numerous stories from across the nation, it's less intense here in Albany, but I mean, if as far as answering calls and what are the priorities, it's money. It's based around monetary value, not so much social value. Because otherwise, they wouldn't do anything related to the drug war. But it's a lot of policing is about, you know, making sure the drug trade is minimized, which is of course a fool's errand. Don't know where to go on from this, but just in general that direct investment. So, like, say if the left, we on the left talk about universal basic income, we're talking about putting money directly in people's hands, and they can make autonomous decisions on how to spend it, and or how to improve themselves with it. Because when you're homeless or just even insecure in one's housing, the consistent amount of money. So it's not feast or famine anymore. you can then develop the better habits of managing resources, your own resources, yourself, and so on. And that's something impossible with, you know, announcement of a grant or this $2 million this year. What about next year?
Right. Universal basic income. Yeah. Is that like, they have that in like Sweden, and they also have it in Saudi Arabia, I want to say.
No. Mm. Sweden had a pilot program, but I covered in a previous episode how they ended it because they have a conservative party that was like, this is, you know, they ended it.
I always thought that there was,
it's
like,
not working.
I want to say there's like, I want to say like the UAE or Saudi Arabia, like any, now.
No.
I don't even want to get into that, but they do technically for their citizens who can only be like actually, like they won't let anyone become a citizen if you're not like Saudi, like genetically Saudi.
I don't know what you mean. I actually,
and they just, they, everybody just gets a salary for living there. Basically.
Well, there's the Alaska social fund where oil revenues go into a fund and everyone gets a piece
of
it.
Just gets like a chunk.
Now, this is the hot new policy on the radical.
Okay,
left,
maybe I'm confusing it with something else.
A social wealth fund, Howie Hawkins of the Green Party and other Greens should be probably mentioning it more soon, as well as other Democratic socialists or real socialists. In fact, it's probably only real socialists, I would consider people real socialists, talking about social wealth fund, because what it does is basically, it's basically buying up a bunch of stocks and or buying up wealth, using the state to buy wealth from the capitalist sector and put it into a democratically controlled public
sector. All right.
So it is literally transferring wealth, not after the fact, after it's made via taxation, but actually as the wealth is being created, transferring it from Wall Street to Main Street. So not just talking about, I'm for Main Street, not Wall Street. What does that mean? What does that mean? How are you? Because if you can't just be neutral about it and say, I'm going to leave Wall Street alone and focus on Main Street. Because Main Street, or rather community economics, are dominated, controlled, and managed by capitalist economics. And there's usually this liberal desire, moderate desire to separate the two. But they're working under the same forces, the same attitudes. Thus my more radical revolutionary point of view, that we need to kind of scrap it or get beyond it. Post-capitalism is kind of what I put on the goal. Let's see if there's anything else from this. There was the community center upgrades. Again, the outreach of violence grant, which is good. It's like conflict mediation, active conflict mediation. Part of the need for less police. A fund. Oh, yeah. So this is a $75,000 victim assistance grant to support additional mobile case and social workers. So I find it interesting that Simeon Nixon, in her debate, mentioned, I want to invest less in law and order and more in social services, which is a great position. I mean, it's one I have. It's what makes her, like, to me, real progressive, or at least a... she's walking the talk when she, say, takes the DSA.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, what does she have to lose by saying... You know what I mean? Like, she's... Mm-hmm. I like her. I agree.
So this was about more social workers. This position will be able to assist both victims of crime. Yeah, so it's about like stopping the cycle of violence. So, you know, one family has a family member murdered, even by accident, and they want retaliation. Police are certainly going to step
in. I'm thinking,
too,
more like women's, like apparently the state of like the women's shelters, at least in this area, is like horrible.
Oh, they're all bad.
And I mean, if we could just like women that are leaving like a domestic violence situation, mm-hmm. provide them with the capital to get out of it.
Right. I mean, it all comes down.
Here you go. Here's a chunk of change.
It all comes down to economic security. And to me, socialism is, having a different economic system that provides economic security and puts that first is, the only thing to like kind of get to the heart of these issues. Otherwise, it's all about transferring money from one side to the other in a trickle down fashion.
Because this does count as trickle-down economics to me, to say, like, the state will provide $2 million
to community centers.
Exactly. Yeah. Why right. is there
what
not
What are the community centers then going to do?
Yeah, why is there not a $50 million budget for community centers in our area?
Right.
You know, it's just not there. The city's budget for the police is $50 million. The budget for the community centers is $50,000. It's nothing.
Yeah.
So, or something pitiful, or just a not even a fraction. So that's yeah. Sorry, I'm sighing here.
That's all right.
Running out of juice.
We're
gonna wind down. I mean, we're gonna stop early. What are you showing?
It's 11:51.
Oh yeah.
Just not letting you know.
I have a clock.
Giving
here.
You. Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So we're gonna wrap up. Oh yeah. So yes, I'll just wrap up and bring up music. So this is the Three Left Show. Thank you for listening. We are on Facebook, Three Left Show. Just type that in. That is our Facebook page. We are on Twitter. I am not actively on Twitter, but I will check that online when I can. So if you tweet there, I will see it once a week. There we have a Patreon page. Please, you can support us. That money will go to supporting the station and allowing me to have the economic security to put more effort into the show, having actual guests. And zany segments and all the like that make these podcasts so much better than just some people jabber. What else? There's the website, threelefts.news. That is all it is, threelefts.news. And that is, there's a full archive of all episodes, and a show notes should be accessible there. And I have to work harder at making sure that they're there. Show notes involve... not yet sources of music. I think that I have to make a separate kind of listing of clips I use. But please just ask if you really need to know. And I will respond quickly. So there's that. On the major podcast apps and so on and so on. Please be part. Feedback is always needed. All right. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.